course, the response is, can we afford not to?
Either you live with the water or you leave. It's the one or the other.
The Drowning City, on Monday night at 8 on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. The president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, has said his country's ground troops are to be banned from calling in NATO air support. The decree follows reports that 10 civilians, including 5 children, were killed in an airstrike during a combined Afghan-NATO attack on a Taliban hideout on Wednesday. Speaking at a military academy in Kabul, President Karzai welcomed the withdrawal of foreign troops and said Afghanistan would show the world it could protect itself. The Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has written to NHS managers in England, urging them not to prevent staff speaking out about issues affecting patient care. It comes after a former chief executive of a Lincolnshire hospital trust broke a gagging order to speak to the BBC about his concerns. In the letter, Mr. Hunt says a culture of openness and transparency is essential to avoid a repeat of the abuse and neglect that led to hundreds of deaths at Stafford Hospital. Britain, France and Germany are calling for international action to tackle tax avoidance by multinational companies. They're urging the G20 finance ministers meeting in Moscow to agree new rules to prevent firms shifting profits to countries with lower corporation taxes. 3 men who were arrested on Thursday in connection with the mislabelling of horse meat have been released on bail. Davith Raw Rees, the owner of Farm Box Meats near Aberystwyth, was arrested along with a 42-year-old man. A 63-year-old man was detained at the Peter Boddy slaughterhouse in West Yorkshire. Both firms deny any wrongdoing. Reports from the United States suggest that the former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. intends to plead guilty to misusing campaign funds. He's accused of spending $750,000, or nearly £500,000, on personal expenses. The Minister of Defence has released the name of a second person killed in an avalanche in the Highlands. Flight Lieutenant Fran Capps, who was 32 and from Somerset, was one of 3 people who died in the Cairngorms on Thursday. And the weather, it'll remain mainly cloudy in northwestern areas this afternoon with patchy light rain and drizzle. Elsewhere, there'll be variable cloud and sunny spells with some showers possible, especially this evening. BBC News and weather at 1:03. And now, here on BBC Radio 3, the Early Music Show and Lucy Skeeping with A Royal Marriage.
Remember this? It's Hubert Parry's I Was Glad, sung at the wedding of Kate and Wills back in 2011. I, for one, was glued to the telly, lapping up the pageantry, the processions, the bride's dress, not to mention the fun of people spotting as they all queued up outside Westminster Abbey. But for sheer force of splendour, the Windsor's little bash is eclipsed by another royal wedding that took place exactly 400 years ago this month between 2 16-year-olds, Princess Elizabeth, daughter of James I, and Frederick V, Elector Palatine. Naturally, there was a serious political purpose behind the union, but by all accounts it was also a genuine love match. And the choice of St. Valentine's Day for the nuptials emphasised the sense of romance.
Mm-hmm.
Ichalatani with two settings of Gray's Inn, part of royal composer John Coprario's music for The Mask of the Inner Temple and Gray's Inn, given to celebrate the marriage of Princess Elizabeth and Frederick V. The Mask was just one of the lavish entertainments laid on for the couple and their noble guests. Frustratingly, only snatches of the music have survived, probably because these were one-off shows and unlikely to be repeated. But at least some of the stage directions have come down to us, giving us an idea of the spectacle and the sheer numbers involved. And that particular music, we're told, was played for the entry of 15 Olympian knights, dressed in long silver capes, embroidered satin doublets, red stockings with silver swords, who took their places one by one within a pavilion draped in cloth of gold. In today's programme, we're going to eavesdrop on some of the wedding entertainments, which began when the young elector, later dubbed the Winter King, arrived in England some months before the actual service. Handsome and quite the gentleman, he immediately made a good impression on the court, and most importantly, of course, on his future bride. And since Elizabeth loved the theatre, around Christmas time, Shakespeare's company, The King's Men, was invited to perform a series of plays at court. One of them was The Tempest, whose love story of an island princess was deemed particularly suitable, and it was given on the betrothal night, the 27th of December. In fact, two of the songs from The Tempest have survived in their original settings. Both are by Robert Johnson and a song by Ariel.
Where the bee sucks, there's a guy. In a cowslip's bed, I lie. There I couch when owls do cry. And the bats back high do fly. After summer, shall I live now under the blossom that hangs on the bough? Merrily, merrily, shall I live now under the blossom that hangs on the bough? Merrily, merrily, shall I live now under the blossom that hangs on the bough? Merrily, merrily, shall I live now under the blossom that hangs on the blossom that hangs on the bough.
Full fathom five thy father lies, of his bones a collar made. Thus a where is ours? Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Seen him sounding his knell, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong.
two songs by Robert Johnson from Shakespeare's The Tempest, Andreas Scholl and Concerta di Viol with Full Fathom Five, and before that Daniel Taylor and the Theatre of Music performed Where the Bee Sucks. Sadly, in early November, in the midst of all the happy wedding celebrations, the unthinkable happened. The bride's brother, Prince Henry, fell ill and died of typhoid, aged just 18. He'd been widely seen as a bright and promising heir to James's throne, and his death was regarded as a great tragedy for the whole nation. Rumours of a papist poisoning abounded. State mourning was decreed, and the pain of his loss was expressed in poetry and music. None better, perhaps, than this song of mourning by Thomas Campion and John Coprario. All looks be pale, hearts cold as stone, for Halley now is dead and gone. countertenor Robin Blaise and lutenist Elizabeth Kenny with All Looks Be Pale by Thomas Campion and John Coprario. Few heirs to the English throne have been as widely and deeply mourned as Prince Henry. For 4 weeks his body lay in state at St James's Palace. His sister's wedding was postponed, but since it was also an important political union, a show of Protestant alliance against the Catholic Habsburgs, it was agreed that the preparations should go ahead, and the date was set for Valentine's Day, the 14th of February 1613. In early December, Frederick was solemnly invested at Windsor with the Order of the Garter. He was presented with a jewel-studded pendant of St George and the Dragon, symbols of the defence of good against evil, which were then emblazoned in a firework display the evening before the wedding. Partying continued long into the night, despite several injuries caused by the fireworks. There was much dancing and feasting, and popular ballads like this, which tells of St George's exploits in a light-hearted way, were sung in the streets and taverns.
Eglamour, that valiant knight, with his father, Langtry, he fetched his sword and he went to fight with his father, Langtry. And as he rode o'er hill and vale, all clothed in his coat of mail,
with his father, Langtry.
A huge great dragon leapt out of his den with his
fa-la-langtry-dandry,
which had killed the Lord knows how many men
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
And when he saw Sir Eglamour, good luck, and you see now the dragon did roar
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
Now this dragon, he had a plaguey hide
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry,
which could but sword and spear abide
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
He could not enter with hacks and cuts, which vexed the knight to his very heart's blood and guts
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
Now as the knight in collar did burn
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry,
he owed that dragon a shrewd good turn
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
In at his mouth his sword he hent, the hilt appeared at his fundament
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
The dragon like a coward began to fly
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry
unto his den, which was hard by
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
And there he laid him down and roared. The knight was vexed for his sword
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
When all this was done, to the alehouse he went
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry,
where by and by his tuppence he spent
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
He was so hot with tugging with a dragon that nothing would quench him but a whole flagon
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
Now God preserve our king and queen
with a fa-la-langtry-dandry,
and eke in London may be seen
with a fa-la-langtry-dandry
as many knights and as many more, and all as good as Sir Eglamour
with his fa-la-langtry-dandry.
lutenist Konrad Ragosnich with Kemp's Jig, a piece named after the comedian in Shakespeare's company, Will Kemp. And before that, we heard The City Waits with a spirited rendering of the tale of Sir Eglamour and how he slew the wondrous dragon. The festivities may have kept most of London awake until the early hours, but the crowds were nevertheless up bright and early the next morning to make sure of a good view outside Whitehall Palace and to gape at the host of English and European nobles as they squeezed into the Royal Chapel, all carefully shown to their places according to rank and influence. The bride certainly didn't disappoint, wearing, reportedly, a crown of refined gold, covered in pearls and diamonds that looked like shining pinnacles upon her amber-coloured hair and hung down over her shoulders to her waist. The service was taken by the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Prince Frederick confidently repeated his vows in English, important since through this union the Church of England was extending its influence into foreign lands. Anthems and psalms rang out, "My help cometh from the Lord, who hath made heaven and earth."
Oh.
My Help Cometh from the Lord, a psalm setting by Thomas Tompkins, performed there by Fretwork with the singers of Alamire and the choir of Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge, directed by David Skinner. As the couple left the chapel, six of the bridegroom's own countrymen on silver trumpets struck up an impressive fanfare which prompted the cry of God give them joy. And the upbeat mood continued that evening and the next when more of London society were invited to masques specially written by Thomas Campion, Francis Beaumont and Francis Bacon. Inigo Jones provided the stage sets and costume designs, and courtiers dressed as fairies, monsters and golden statues sang and danced to music for Broken Consort. There was no rest the following evening either, not even for the young couple who'd barely got to know each other. A torchlit parade made its way through the London streets. Gentlemen of the Middle Temple in decorated chariots accompanied by men wielding axes and swords. This time the theme was the New World, the maskers styled as Native Americans whose songs showed they had accepted Christianity into their hearts. By day three, King James had just about had it and retired to his bed. So the final masque was postponed for 5 days, at which point the weary, overfed wedding guests somehow managed to summon up the energy to cheer the flotilla which made its way up the Thames to the accompaniment of fire, peals of bells and, of course, more glorious music.
Thank you.
Win her and woo her, he that can. A song by Thomas Campion and a fitting theme for the marriage of Princess Elizabeth to Frederick Elector Palatine that took place on Valentine's Day 1613, almost exactly 400 years ago. The countertenor Robin Blaise with Elizabeth Kenny on the lute. And before that we heard music from The Wedding Masks by John Coprario and Robert Johnson. So what about the wedding presents? Well, Frederick's gift to his bride included fabulous tapestries and a monkey house. So full marks there for originality anyway. Another gift was a collection of music entitled Parthenia, containing pieces by William Byrd, John Bull and Orlando Gibbons. And as the title page declared, the notes E for Elizabeth and F for Frederick played together symbolised the harmony of marriage.
Thank you.
The Earl of Salisbury's Pavan and Galliard, performed by David Ponsford, one of the 21 pieces in Parthenia, a book of virginal music given as a wedding present to Princess Elizabeth and Frederick V. The couple finally departed towards the end of April. Sailing from Margate, their first stop was The Hague, where they were warmly welcomed by Frederick's uncle, Count Maurits, Prince of Orange. Passing slowly through the Netherlands, everywhere they were regaled with banquets, presents and entertainments, and as they floated up the Rhine in a richly decorated barge, few would have missed the symbolism of the uniting of that river with the Thames. The princess had brought with her her own musicians to perform at the various points where the cavalcade stopped. Chief amongst them were Orlando Gibbons and John Coprario, and Leiden's composer Cornelis Schout and the town musicians were expected to answer in kind.
Thank you.
the Netherlands Chamber Choir, directed by Paul van Nevel, with Voi Bramati Ben Mio by Cornelis Schout. And before that, the Rose Consort of Viols, played a Galliard by Orlando Gibbons. At last, on the 7th of June, Princess Elizabeth arrived in the capital city of Heidelberg, which would be her new home. To the sound of violins, lutes and voices, she passed through several elaborate arches erected in her honour by students of the town's university, until finally the cavalcade began the steep ascent to the castle, a vast and romantic edifice on a hill overlooking the river. But if she imagined she might finally have a little time to acclimatise to her new surroundings, she was wrong. Now, and for some days, Heidelberg Castle simply buzzed with entertainments, tournaments, processions, feasts and pageants. Triumphal chariots containing mythical deities rolled by. In one of them stood Frederick, dressed as Jason, in an allegory which compared the story of the Argonauts with the strength and grace of the young Elector himself. The organ played and the singers declared, "Now all the gods are descending from the heavens to honour you, lovely princess."
Thank you.
Music heard at Heidelberg Castle as part of the entertainments given in the summer of 1613 to welcome Princess Elizabeth to her new home. The English retinue now departed, and with her connections to England officially severed, Elizabeth was henceforth known as the Electress Palatine of the Rhine. No one in the Holy Roman Empire can have failed to know that the Elector had married the daughter of the King of England. It was a political alliance that would strengthen the Protestant cause. But it was also, it seems, a genuine love match.
Thank you.
Hesperion 21, directed by Jordi Savall, with two fantasias by Alfonso Ferrabosco the Younger. And it ends today's Early Music Show, which was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Sam Phillips. In tomorrow's programme, Catherine Bott will be exploring the music and life of Girolamo Frescobaldi. That's at the same time, just after 1 o'clock. Well, Radio 3's Sunday celebration of all things choral, the choir, continues its sequence of special programmes with guest presenters from across the choral world. And this week, it'll be presented by Ken Burton.
On the choir tomorrow on BBC Radio 3, I'm going to be joined by the conductor of the ACM Gospel Choir, Mark DeLissa, whose group made it through to the last choir standing semi-finals in 2008. We'll be chatting about his choir's unique new gospel sound. I'll also be journeying through some of the more unusual realms of gospel music, such as when classical meets gospel. So do join me, Ken Burton, and my guests on The Choir tomorrow at 5 o'clock, only here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now we're about to hear the Radio 3 lunchtime concert, a second chance to hear last Monday's live broadcast from Wigmore Hall in London. It's introduced by Sarah Walker.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall and to a recital of masterpieces by Chopin and Ravel given by the pianist Katia Buniatishvili. She's no stranger to Radio 3. From 2009 to 11, she was one of our new generation artists and quickly developed a fine reputation as a highly individual musician. People say sparks fly whenever she makes music. But she acknowledges that there's a melancholy undertone to her playing at times, springing from her Georgian background and interest in her native folk music. Well, those contrasting qualities will definitely be put to good use in Ravel's La Valse coming up later. But first, we have three works by Chopin, a pair of scherzos, and first of all, the Piano Sonata No. 2 in B-flat minor. This is the sonata with the famous funeral march as its third movement, incredibly sombre. But the other three movements are very different. In fact, there's a lovely quote from Schumann who said that in this piece, Chopin had bound together four of his most unruly children. Well, I think many of us would just describe these children as having strong personalities. It's certainly an impressive work all round. And here comes Katia Buniatishvili now onto the Wigmore Hall stage to perform Chopin's Piano Sonata No. 2 in B-flat minor.